Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'd like to introduce the panelists, and let me tell you, I'm pretty proud to be up here as the moderator, given who the panelists are. First, we'll introduce John LaSqua. John, smile and wave. John, this fall, watch the Miss America pageant. Work on your waving. Okay. John's a local boy. He went to Sarah in San Mateo. By the way, my son just graduated from Bellarmine in San Jose. If he knew I was introducing someone from Sarah, I'd be in big trouble at home.
It's bad.
But in any case, John grew up, and he crossed the bay to attend the university that's across the street. He's had some mild success with books that make regular appearances on the New York Times bestseller list, and that have been translated into 22 languages. When I showed this to John, he said, "Oh, this is great, Keith. Thanks for the introduction. It's not 16 languages; it's 22. 22 languages in more than 75 countries. Can anybody here name 75 countries? I'm sure John can't either." One of my favorite crime writers, Zoe Ferraris, wrote in the San Francisco Chronicle that John's 27th book. If you don't like John, that's good enough reason right there. 27th book, Fatal, is a, quote, dark, disturbing, satisfying read. We have our friend from Copenhagen who's here, Tomas, and I would say Rydahl, but it's Reed. Go ahead.
Rydahl.
Yeah, Thomas Rydahl. Unlike John, Thomas is not a local boy. He lives north of Copenhagen. And how would we say Copenhagen in Danish?
København.
Yeah, see? Along with his wife, two children, four cats, a dog. Yeah, okay, that's so now you've won friends over here. Four cats, a dog, and a hamster.
It died. The hamster died. I didn't tell you.
Oh. Yeah. All right, you're going to get the sympathy vote now, Tomas.
Did you kill it?
Someone asked how the hamster died, and Tomas is told me, wait for book three and you'll find
exactly,
out.
Yeah.
He has two books out featuring Erhard Jorgensen. Jorgensen, right?
You're doing good.
Close enough.
Yeah.
The 60th Nine-Fingered Hermit. The first of those, titled, unsurprisingly, The Hermit, won the Glass Key Award in 2015 for Best Nordic Crime Novel. It's a lot of competition there, too. And it's just been released here in the States. Publishers Weekly calls it brilliant and scathing. Mm. Congrats to you, Tomas.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Bradley Spinelli here, too. And I'm going to give you... Bradley has a big family. And I'm going to give you a brief bio, which I swear I didn't make up. Killing Williamsburg, his debut novel, won the 2013 Naked Girls Reading Literary Honors. How can I get my books in the competition for that? I don't know. He co-founded the magazine Burlesque Beat and directed the movie Hashtag Annie Hall, which is pretty funny. His latest novel, The Painted Gun, is set in the city. For those of you from the East Coast, the city is across the bay here. Publishers Weekly called a, quote, tricky and delightfully surprising crime novel. Nice to have you here, Bradley.
Thanks.
Me, I'm Keith Raffel. I have career ADD. I taught writing to college freshmen, served as counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has been in the news of late, run for Congress, splat, founded a software company, managed a DNA sequencing business, and whiled away a year-long fellowship back east, at a university back east. The New York Times was kind enough to call my debut novel worthy of a Steve Jobs keynote presentation. And the East Coast, no one cares about that, but out here people think, hey, that's kind of cool, and so do I. Currently, I'm doing my absolute damnedest to finish up The End of Me, which will be my sixth thriller. except we don't have a drama. You know, so Jana Rudolph is here clapping, and she's doing it so perfunctorily that it hardly counts. All right, so we've got questions, but we'll have questions at the end for you. Questions, if you want to ask a question, there are a couple requirements. It has to be nasty, scathing, and put someone on the spot. But ask anything you want after that. Okay, there's an old joke about the difference between a mystery and a thriller. The difference between a mystery and a thriller is, according to that joke, is one place, one digit in the advance.
God bless thrillers.
God bless. All right, well, John, why don't you tell us the difference in your mind between a mystery and a thriller?
Well, in a thriller, you're not just concerned with the whodunit aspect of the crime. You're more involved with the people and the agonies that they are put through in the course of the novel.
Okay, so, Bradley, give us a better answer than that.
Yeah, that was
I don't understand how this is my problem. I'm just trying to write books. Like, I feel like the critics and the marketing department and, you know, college professors can break apart which category everything has to go in.
Well, wait a minute. Here's it. We're going to be interrupting here all day.
Please.
This is not like, you know, tooting my own horn, but I happen to be the president of the International Thriller Writers. Your organization?
Well, you know, I will say on the way over here, since I'm a member of ITW, John said I could call him Your Excellency.
You all can. I mean, it's an open invitation. Anyway, what happened, this is where the real thriller versus mystery came about, is the Mystery Writers of America, God love them. We noticed, however, us people who were writing a little bit of a different kind of a mystery, that we weren't getting nominated for awards.
Hmm. Well, yeah, certainly. So what you're saying, John, is that the best way to win an award is to start an award.
Start a new organization. Gail Lenz and David Morrell both decided, you know, we need a thriller group. Hmm. And now we have 3,800 members, and it's fantastic. So, but I think a lot of it has to do with that marketing question of, you know, well, it's a thriller if you're going to try to make a living at it.
Hmm. So, Tomas, one thing we've learned this week is to look for truth and justice. In the United States, it's best to look to Europe. So tell us what the difference between a mystery and a thriller is. Tell these Americans.
Okay, I'll do that. No, I think I agree with both of these guys that it's, I mean, I just wrote a book and then I asked someone, you know, what is this? And then they told me and then I'm like, okay, we'll go with that. So, yeah, I mean, actually, I'm not so concerned about the genres, and that's a problem sometimes because they want to call it something, and it's easier to talk about something that's something rather than nothing. So
about your book, what's the something you talk about?
Well, I mean, I guess I call it a literary thriller because it's that kind of a book, but it really was something.
So you have to be a college grad to read it?
I hope not, but I'm concerned with language also, so that's why my publisher came up with that.
And what do you think about the translation that they did of your book? Your English is pretty good, so you should be able to tell how good the translation is.
Well, I think it's hard. I mean, I'm pretty good, but it's still that there's so many nuances. But I think he did a good job. But I also have it like he's a crime sort of a translator, and I think maybe he didn't lean so much towards the literary that I would like, but I think he did a good job.
Bradley, wouldn't it be great if we could blame the translator for our books?
Yeah, I think that would be pretty cool. But John, you'd have to know more about the language, obviously, to be able to know where to point the finger.
Yeah, the other thing is this literary thriller genre that we're talking about. When I started writing thrillers, and some people commented that they were nicely written, and, you know, some even said they were literate. And my publisher and agent both said, run from that like the plague. Mm. Do not let people call you a literary thriller writer because you won't make it. No. It's a little cynical there in New York from time to time.
Yeah, but literary fiction in general is just another genre, right? It's generally, you know, the protagonist is generally a writer. He's probably a college professor. He's definitely He's definitely having a midlife crisis. That's how you know it's literature, right? We're in.
Okay, so Bradley.
Totally.
So let's talk about what's really a thriller as compared to literary fiction. How do you thrill a reader? How do you grab them? How does it happen? What do you have to show them?
I mean, I think
Give us some examples from your own writing.
I mean, I just always start with the people. Like, these are the people. These are the people in the situation that they're in. You know, and I know that, like,
what
mysteries.
Kind of situation?
And, Well, like my new book is, you know, about a guy who just becomes accidentally a detective. He has this case sort of thrust on him, and he gets caught up in it. But what to me is more interesting about him is that he's kind of a jerk. And, like, you sort of care about him in that jerky kind of way. And so it's a little bit more, it builds nervousness, I think, when you, like, feel something about who the person is. Like, that's how you get thrilling. That's how you make it happen. You don't grab a person by, you know, pointing a gun to their head. You grab a person by pointing a gun to their wife's head. You know, they care what's going to happen, and now they're really concerned. No, I feel like I just scared the shit out of everyone. How am I doing?
Yeah. Well, there are wives who say, no, put it against my husband's head. But, yeah, totally. Gentlemen, you know.
Well, I mean, we've all been saying that it's a matter of the characters, and the characters have to be in jeopardy, and you have to put them in jeopardy early. And it's better if you don't really have like a super fantastic shoot 'em up opening page sometimes, except sometimes you just want to have something blow up. And so you blow something up, or you burn down a house, or you have somebody get in a car wreck, and then you leave that alone for the next 150 pages. You just go, okay, and so the hook is set, and you go, what does this have to do with everything else that I'm writing about? Mm. And then you start laying the people out there, and the people are the people we care about, and that's what makes it thrilling.
So I think it was Mickey Spillane who says that an author writes the first page so the reader will finish that book, and the writer writes the last page so that people will read the next book. Mm. Okay, Tomas, let's make a thriller stew. Mm. Let's do some cooking. What ingredients do you throw in the pot? Darkness, betrayal, urgency, atmosphere. What do you have to have in there for that thriller to be compelling?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I definitely think you need, I mean, you need what these guys are saying. You need some, you know, you need a character that you, you know, sympathize with, or you can see yourself in some way. And I think you need to, I mean, usually if I teach, I talk about, you know, the character, the location of the story, and also, of course, the plot or the story itself.
Yeah, there's always that plot, damn it.
Yeah. And then, but then I think, you know, it's like you need all of that, and then you need, you know, whoever you are, your own personality, you need to bring that to the book as well. So it gets to be not just, as you say, it's not just the ingredients, it's something else. You need, it has to be something personal, and this has to be something at stake, both for the, like, in the story, but also in the characters, I think. So that would be my sort of, and then maybe throw in a bit, you know, awkwardness, some chili, and a couple of hamsters, and then you got it going.
So Bradley, speaking as someone who co-founded a magazine called Burlesque Heat, what part does sex play in all this?
Oh, I have to say it's Burlesque Beat. And
oh,
I do have to say that because Burlesque Beat is actually covering the Burlesque Hall of Fame Weekender in Las Vegas, Nevada this weekend. I flew in from it yesterday, and I'm flying back out to it immediately after this panel. So, look.
So when you're making the stew, you know, how much sex do you
Everybody's into sex. But I think people have different ideas about how much they're willing to admit they're into sex. So I think you have to decide at some point, like, how much you're going to give to an audience. It needs to be appropriate for, like, the rest of the book. You know, my latest book, The Painted Gun, I really wanted to keep it PG-13 because I wanted my mother to read it. So I really did the, you know, all the sex happens off camera and it's all fun. You know, my previous novel.
I tell my kids that my books are PG-31.
Yeah. Yeah, my previous, in Killing Williamsburg, there was a lot of sex, and in a pretty fun way, if you like that sort of thing. So I think it depends. It needs to go with the rest of the atmosphere. That novel's about a suicide epidemic, so there are a number of exceedingly graphic and creative suicides throughout the course of the book. So if you're going to read this book, you're going to be fine with the sex parts. Like, this is the least of my concerns about putting you off, because if that's not for you, you're gone already.
So sex in that book is sort of, it's not adding to stress, it's subtracting.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes sort of like a panacea in a little bit. You're like, oh, well, this is kind of a nice moment. At least these people are enjoying themselves.
So before they kill each other, themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, John, yeah. Your latest book has a female protagonist.
Yes, it does.
So what difference does it make when you're writing a thriller, having a female protagonist versus a male protagonist for you?
Well, you know, the women are nicer.
It's smarter.
Smarter.
Better looking. Okay.
Thank you.
But besides those
obvious things. I've answered
that.
Yeah. You know, I don't really notice any difference. I mean, I do notice that I'm trying to write true characters, whether they're male or female. But I didn't know who was going to be the star of my book, Fatal, until I was about 120 pages into it. Mm. She was just one of a cast of characters. And I didn't even know she was a cop. And we met her on page one, and we meet her as this friend of a friend, and we think we're looking at the friend, and it turns out we're looking at her. So she just kind of pops back in and out until about page 120 when she takes over the book.
So I have a friend who writes books, who's a female woman, who writes books from the perspective of a man. And so I read the book, and I said, you know, you brilliantly capture this, except at one point you say that the protagonist sees a woman and she's wearing strappy shoes. Has any man ever said strappy shoes?
Actually, those were wedges. They were wedges.
So John, Mr. Burlesque here can do it. Yeah. You know.
So John,
expand your world.
John, so my question for you, John, is who reads the book to make sure you don't make that kind of cross sexual
mistake?
Oh
my God, I have
mistake.
More editors than you know than Jesus had apostles. I mean, it's. I have my best friend Al Giannini is a lawyer. And he's the guy who reads for all legal stuff. Since
I'm talking about for the female perspective stuff. Who reads that? Who reads
well,
that?
Well, I have another editor named Peggy Knotts. She lives right here, right around the corner. And
so where is she?
She's not here.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
she's
that
my
says
editor.
Something.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little careful. So, no. I mean, she goes through. Well, I have my regular editor at Simon & Schuster. They read it. They both read it. I have two of them. One of them is a woman. One's a guy. And then my editor that I pay for, Peggy, I pay for her independent work, and she finds those kind of glitches that are just wrong. And I think by the end, it's been read by 100 people and it's probably, hopefully, got no errors in it, except the typos, that, of course, that get in every time.
So, Tomas, you write about a hermit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about someone who's a professional.
No.
Yeah, so tell us about writing about someone who's off the grid. And
yeah. I felt like that was a complete privilege because I got to be like the amateur detective like he is, and I really, like, when I created the mystery part of this story, I didn't know, I was like on the same tour that he is. I was discovering along the book. So I basically created a problem for myself in the beginning of the book that my hermit, he gets involved with this, the finding of a young child that has died inside a car, and I didn't know at the point what happened, so I had to jog along with this guy and find out what happened to this kid.
So John just said it was page 120 before he even knew who the protagonist of the book was.
Yeah.
So you started out and you didn't know what was going to happen. Bradley, do you write that way too?
No, not really. Not for the no. I would say no. My two published books are both told first person, so you know who's talking from the very beginning. The book that I just finished last year is half set in Brooklyn, half set in Bangkok, and sort of two protagonists with the narrative.
So you knew what was
going to
happen in the book the whole.
I wouldn't say you know what's going to happen, but like, yeah, that's bonkers to me to not know who, you know, whose story it is, really.
It's better.
So wait a minute. I just want to get this straight. So the only way to write a good thriller is to know what's going to happen.
That is not what I said, Keith.
So what did you?
I said I can't imagine working that way. That would make me nuts, and I got enough issues.
I think you should know. I mean, definitely for me, it was important to know where I was going, but I didn't know. Like, I knew where the story was going, but I didn't know exactly how to get there. So it's like, okay, I go down this street. No, this street works better. But I knew where I was going. I needed to because otherwise I couldn't construct that kind of. It's quite a construction, the story. So
E.L. Doctorow, famous novelist, once said that writing a book for him was like driving in a car on a foggy night with the headlights on. You could see a few feet in front of the car and no further, and yet you arrive at your destination anyway.
That's exactly my experience. Exactly. I don't know. I have no idea at all what my books are going to be about when I start them. And I don't even usually know until I'm on page 200 or 300.
So do you ever have to throw away 100 pages?
Never, no. I never throw away a page. I figure out some way to get it in.
Because it's so excruciating to write each page.
Individual scenes are all I care about, really. I mean, if you write a good enough scene after good enough scene after good enough scene, suddenly you're at the end of the book, something's happened, and it's been fun to read the whole time.
So we were just talking to Tomas about writing about a hermit. And in your latest, of course, you write books with lawyers.
Yeah.
And you're writing a book this time with a police officer.
Which time?
Fatal.
Oh, yeah. Police officer.
Your latest book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying
to help.
Well,
here's the funny thing. Fatal's out now. It just came out in January, okay? My 2018 book is done. I handed it in October.
And so do you have copies for all of us?
I don't even know the title of it yet. I handed it in October. Okay, they've accepted it. They paid me. I'm real happy. Everything's good. But that book is done, and I'm now on page 90 of my 2019 book, which I have no idea what it's about.
So someday, I hate to talk about this, John, but someday, 40 or 50 years from now, you'll pass from this earth. And then you're going to be and you're going to be the Michael Crichton of the mid-century, aren't you? You're going to have books coming out for years after your past.
It's not impossible. It's not impossible. I just, you know, I'm lucky I have a contract, and they want, you know, they wanted three books, so I'm writing book three of the contract.
So what's the difference between writing from the perspective of a police officer versus an attorney?
Oh, the mindset is completely different.
Tell us about it.
Cops don't tell anybody anything, ever. And lawyers do tell you everything, but they're lying. I'm serious. That is exactly it. That's the difference between a cop and a lawyer.
So
in a book. Anyway.
Mr. Mueller in Washington might want to hire you.
He might want to have me around.
Yes. All right.
That was a pretty good answer, wasn't it?
You know,
that was damn good.
In truth, put your hands over your ears, guys.
They're all good.
All right. So in your thriller, do you need a MacGuffin? Something to chase in what you write. What are you chasing? Is it a bomb you're trying to stop? Is it a gold cache that you're trying to find? You're trying to find the Temple of Doom. What are you trying to do, Bradley?
In film theory, for those who don't know it, a MacGuffin actually doesn't have to be anything at all. My best example of a MacGuffin is the gold suitcase in Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino's movie. You never find out what's in that fucking suitcase, right? So it's a true MacGuffin because the object itself matters not at all. It exists only to drive the plot. So I'd say in that sense, I try to never use MacGuffins. I mean, I want to have something that exists to drive the plot, but also has some other inherent meaning. You know, I'm trying to create an equation here that doesn't have a remainder, so that if you took anything out, the whole thing would fall apart. So I want to like send people looking for something that's going to send them to something that's going to spin something else off in another direction, and you're not going to see the whole picture until you know you get to the other side. So that's my feeling.
So give me a hand here, because I don't agree, but I'm the moderator, so I'm not supposed to argue with you. So if I read Dashiell Hammett or something, the Maltese Falcon is in fact the MacGuffin of the Maltese Falcon. It doesn't really matter.
Agreed.
But which to me is, you know, the be all and end all. So. Why is what you're chasing, why is the MacGuffin important, Thomas?
Well, I mean,
or not. Agree with Bradley.
I think you need something to drive the plot or the storyline. So there needs to be something, but it could be basically anything. And like in my story, it's this, my hermit wants to solve what happened to this kid's parents. And that gets to be like his thing. And then of course, along the road, he finds out a lot about, you know, himself and, you know, the society that he's a part of. So it's like the thing that drives the action. And then of course, there's a turn where you find out that it's actually not about the parents. There's a bigger story, and then he gets into that, and then maybe the MacGuffin changes a little bit, the Maltese Falcon.
So I think most of the time a MacGuffin is something rather than a person or motivation. So I'm afraid that you're agreeing with Bradley here.
Yeah, but
I'll get even with you later.
Sorry.
I'm going to be 3-0 against you.
Boom.
Oh, you know, but please know what John said. It's 3-0. Three of them versus nothing. Yes.
And I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, you don't necessarily need a MacGuffin. If you're telling a real story, if you're getting close to that magical literary mystery that we were talking about, or literary thriller, you get closer and closer to not needing anything like a MacGuffin. Because you're just following people.
So
you've
give me
lost
a,
this one.
So, not
you
yet.
Are totally lost.
No, the Electoral College I won. Okay, how many people think you need a MacGuffin in a thriller? Okay, I lost.
Wow. Let the podcast record show that nobody raised their hand. Nobody.
Yeah, that, you know.
I think I'm going to move for impeaching the panel moderator.
But I do think it has to be about something. There has to be like something that they chase. So is it like a symbolic MacGuffin? I think
a thematic thing. I think that's more the MacGuffin that people nowadays tend to gravitate towards, I think.
Mm. Well, so it's interesting that you should say that, John, because you said you didn't care about anything. You just wanted to write the scenes.
Right.
So does that mean in a thriller that plot dominates over things like settings and characters? You know, it's driven the whole way through?
I don't
help him here. This is John.
I don't know. What can I tell you?
I'm dumbfounded because John often doesn't know, but he always makes stuff up anyway. Uh-huh. Not this time.
It's the job.
Yeah, Bradley.
Make up stuff.
I wouldn't say that it necessarily dominates, but I definitely would say that it has a much bigger a prominence. In my other work, I don't get the same kind of. When I was working on The Painted Gun, I called it a plot headache. I would get a specific headache in a certain part of my brain that came from trying to do the math of the plot. Mm. You know, where you just would like you'd be like trying to figure out something, trying to make something work, and it was just like. I don't get that with other work where it's not so heavy. But I wouldn't say that it dominates. You know, if you don't have great characters,
right.
then who cares
who
what
cares?
Happens to them?
Right.
Like, well,
it is a funny,
it's always about the characters.
Well, it's a funny thing. Speaking as a reader and not a writer for a moment, it's a funny thing when you talk about your favorite stuff, and the Maltese Falcon or whatever. In the Maltese Falcon, you remember the characters. You don't really even care about the plot. No. At the same time, if you don't have that infernal plot, the readers, you guys, will refuse to turn the pages.
Well, stuff's got to happen. But you know what? Character is revealed through action, which means to show the person that you're going to love eventually, or you're going to root for, or you're going to hate, you have them do either reprehensible or wonderful things. So they're moving, there's action at all times. Every scene has an advancement of the plot, but really, it's not that. It's you've got great characters that are revealed through action.
So, Tomas, are you going to agree with him again?
Yes.
Oh. How are we going to have an interesting panel if you're always agreeing? But go.
Some of the reviews for my books have been that, you know, that...
You read your reviews?
I've been referred, you know. But, they've been pretty good, so I read some of them. But, to be honest, in a way, I don't care so much about the plot that I care about the characters, but I still think that in any good story, even if it's not a thriller or anything, that you need to have like something you want to find out. You know, I just read the, what's the name? I can't remember. New York writer about a bird on a painting.
Donatard,
yeah. I just read that. And you have
so what
that.
Is that. What is that in Danish?
Stillisen.
Yeah, you could have just told us that.
Yeah, that's why I couldn't come up with the. But I think, you know, then there's a story in that. There's a thing you want. You're chasing this painting.
There's a MacGuffin.
The story. Yeah, exactly.
That's a MacGuffin.
So
a MacGuffin.
Yeah, it is. But there's still this thing running through the story. And I think, for me, that's what I'm looking for. And I think that's why we love literature, is because it sort of builds this mind, whatever you call it, knowledge gap, and you want to close the gap. What happens, you know? And so I think that needs to be in there. But then if you don't have a character you either love or you're in fighting with, like I was with my character, then there's nothing, you know, there's no way to relate to the story. So you need the characters there as well. So, yeah.
So when I started reading thrillers when I was a kid, you would read Ian Fleming, or you would read John le Carre, Ross Thomas, and all the thrillers seemed to be about the Cold War. And it was so easy. You'd have these villains in there. You knew what you were fighting for, and it made it easy. So have we lost something? Is it possible? Have we lost something?
Oh, no, it's back. You've heard about this, right? It's back. It's all about Russia once again. Only this time half of our government is down with them, and the other half is confused about what's happening. Yeah, we're back.
Sad.
It's the 80s.
Sad. But it's just sad.
But when you're looking at the books you guys have written, can you write a thriller with the stakes as high as they were back in those great books of the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
I think it's from coming from Scandinavia, and we have a tradition of, I don't know if you know, Sjöwall and Valur, which I don't know if they're big here, but they did the Beck. It's like the...
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And what I love...
I just never heard it pronounced properly before,
okay.
But yes.
What do you call them then? You don't have a name for them, or are they just... What do you call them? Here.
I would have
Sjöwall.
Said...
What do you call them now?
Well, no, I know how to spell them. Okay. I know how to spell the author's name, just not how to say them.
Sure. So it's, but what I liked about those
Beck,
is, for
Beck,
me, it was a shock, because I used to watch a lot of those American, like, crime series.
What
do you call it?
What's the Danish?
You know all those guys from the 70s and the 80s, like
Mannix,
Miami Vice.
Miami Vice.
Kind of okay. And then all of a sudden I found these Swedish crime books in my parents' study, right? And they were like social realism. And, you know, the detective was getting, you know, a divorce and stuff like that. So that's like a shock that you could actually have that in a crime setting. And I loved it. And I think... So I think, you know, you don't have to have the story be that epic, but you need to, like what we're talking about, you need to relate to the character. You need, there needs to be like something that you really want to see them solving. But if it's world peace or, yeah, find out who killed the hamster, it doesn't matter really. There was this story about a kid who's solving like the dog that died in the night or something like that. That's an, yeah. So, I mean, that's a great
incident.
Example.
Yeah.
That's a great example that the story doesn't have to be, you know, huge for us to be invested in the story.
Bradley?
I mean, I'm with him. I mean, I grew up in that period for sure. Like, I mean, the Cold War was everything, and you know, James Bond, you know, the coolest character ever. And, you know, all of us wanted to be James Bond, and it's nice to know who the villains are, right? It's a shortcut. It seems easy. This is why Star Wars, I think, is just continuing to be so popular, because there's the good guys, there's the bad guys, and weirdly, like, the way you look at the story, isn't it wrong? Because aren't the rebels the bad guys? Like, in Star Wars, you know, the guys who are trying to overthrow the government, shouldn't those be the bad guys? I don't know. Maybe it's only in America
that like
the
George
revolutionaries
Washington?
Sound
yeah.
like the good guys.
Bad guy,
like,
George Washington.
Because
yep.
in my head, I feel like it's all the same, really. You know, a lot of writers write about how cops and robbers are mm-hmm. essentially cut from the same cloth. I always try to write about characters who are sort of bad people who want to be good. Because I think that's true of a lot of people. Yeah. I think a Cold War, anything like that, it just makes it easy. It's a shortcut. It's a quick way in. Mm. It's like telling somebody your zodiac sign. Maybe they'll understand why you're weird. But you don't need it. You don't need it.
John, how do you come up with the great villains then? We're talking about the Cold War stuff, and you'd have Rosa Krebs, remember, in the James Bond stuff, Carla in the John le Carre stuff. Great villains. How do you come up with a great villain when you're writing in 2017?
You give them some power. You put them in the DA's office, for example, and you have them prosecute the wrong person for the wrong reasons. And that's so universal that everybody relates to it and they know who the bad guy is, and it's just as big a theme as the Cold War type themes. It's just on a different stage. That's what I think. Mm.
Yeah, so now you want to humanize the villains in a way
you have to
and not make
everybody.
Them iconic the way
you have,
they used to be.
You have to humanize everybody. Everybody you write about has got to be a human being. Otherwise, there's no connection to any of it.
Yeah.
So the whole reality of it is based on how the people act and who are and what. You can do a little shortcut, give them a job where they can abuse their power. And abuse of power is just a universal theme. And it's, you know, a good one to come back to time and again, frankly.
So Tomas, you write about an outsider.
Yeah.
And obviously finding the villains in the insiders in society.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think the some people say that, you know, the hero is only as good as the opposition or the villain, and I think it's a really interesting balance to keep them. I mean, to keep them at the place where they're, you know, you almost like the villains, and then you still know that they're wrong in some way, so you want to see them finished off in some way. But I'm not very structured or anything, so for me to structure my story, I thought about The Simpsons, you know, the TV series, and I thought about, you know, I need to have the mayor and the, you know, the cop and all that, and then I tried to take all of these roles that we know already, and I tried to expand them and twist them and give them, like as soon as you start to learn a character, I tried to twist them a little bit, so they would appear, you know, different from what you would expect, and so also I did this with my main villain, like to give him nuances, because I thought that was just and also to have him mirror very much my hero, so they had like a lot of commonalities or things they shared. So
Bradley, you said one of the great things about Star Wars is the villain, and certainly I'd rather write Darth Vader than Luke any day. Darth Vader is more interesting. So is it more interesting for you to write the villains than the protagonists?
Well, I enjoy both, because I think that they're all have conflicting you know, points of view, conflicting drives.
Sort of the commonality in the commonality.
Yeah, I see.
Too.
I see. Yeah. You know, I write about even my protagonists have a lot of negative qualities, and I like to sort of spruce that up. I build the villain by withholding information and by trying to make some of the villains very. You know, understandable as well. So you have some sympathy even for the more quote unquote evil characters. I mean, the primary villain in The Painted Gun, I do it by withholding information in the sense that he doesn't say very much. So he's this presence that you have to sort of figure out. And then there are other minor or in some cases larger villains that you don't know they're villains when you first meet them. So I'm withholding information from the reader that way. I like to play with it. I don't think that it's ever really that black and white.
So, John, do you like to put yourself in the head of the villain?
Yeah, I think it's really fun to make a bad person do kind of good things and make a good person do bad things. Mm. And it confuses the reader, I think, in a nice way. And I really, I think I try to do that in every book. In fact, in every character in every book. Because that's how you get complexity. Mm.
So let's get a little personal here. I mentioned E.L. Doctorow in the quote about the headlights in the car. Mm-hmm. One of my two favorite literary quotes. The other one's E.L. Doctorow, too. And he says, writing is a socially acceptable form of schizophrenia. which I absolutely understand. You know, so what do... I mean, I'll talk about myself here for a second. So what do I do for a living? I sit down... put on some headphones, start drinking green tea, then I hear voices talking to me, I feel I'm in another world and I'm writing it all down. You know, if you look in the, what do they call it, the statistic, the abstract, the whatever it is about...
DSM.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, you look that up and it's right there under schizophrenia, what we do. So, Tomas, how crazy are you?
Well, I don't think I'm that crazy, but I've been told I'm crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, but... I think other people think I'm pretty crazy sometimes. Well, I actually, talking about the sex stuff before, I had an experience because I don't have a study, so I go to a local art museum where I sit in the cafe and I write my books there.
Cafe too.
And then one Friday night, I was like sneaking out of the house and I went to write on my book. And then I didn't have a plan.
It's pretty good to be married to a thriller writer. When they sneak out of the house, they're going to write.
Exactly. But then I went to the museum and I started writing, and it's like a really nice museum. And so there's a lot of people sitting and, you know, eating salmon and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden I found out that I was writing a sex scene, right? And I was sitting there writing the sex scene, and people are all happy, and I really felt like a pervert sitting there and writing that. I was like, oh my gosh, I don't hope they, you know, they see what I'm writing. But it was, I mean, it was such a thrill to write that scene, so I was just completely immersed in that. But that's the privilege, that we get to disappear into this, you know, the world that we made up on our own.
And given how the world that we live in when we're not writing is doing, it's nice to disappear
exactly,
in that world,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a way of escaping, but it's also a way of, I mean, I guess for some of us, it's also a way of being really, you know, releasing what's there and, you know, your fears and your, you know, your hopes and dreams. And, you know, because, I mean, for me, like writing about a 67-year-old who fled Denmark and left his wife and family and all that behind, for me, it was more like the fear of becoming him that I actually was writing towards or against.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. So John writes oftentimes about an attorney, and one of the rules about being in the courtroom is you never ask a witness a question without knowing what her or his answer will be. So I'm going to violate that here now and ask John just how crazy he is.
You know, I live in a suburban house with two grown-up children and wife of 35 years, and I'd think I'm not crazy at all, really.
You're not channeling another world.
I'm living in an alternative universe at all times.
Yeah, except for that.
Because of the, you know, I've written, I don't even know how many, 27 books.
That's what I counted.
Well, and you know, that San Francisco is parallel to the real San Francisco. And San Francisco is in all the books. And I find that those are very real, the places that I've written about, even if they're not based on real places in the city, they're as real or more real than the real places. Because we'll be going out to dinner, and I'll say to Lisa, I'll go, hey, look, that's where, you know, Helena got shot four books ago. And it's very real to me, you know, I mean, Helena got shot there. I feel bad. But,
you know. I recently took one of my kids on a college visit, and yeah. So we were in D.C., where I have one of my books set, and we're in the elevator, and I'm going, oh, my God, you know, someone was shot in this elevator in the Hilton. And then I said, no, that was in a book. And
yeah. My daughter once called me. She lives in San Jose now, and she's actually a lawyer, and she called me.
What have you done?
I have two kids, and they're both lawyers.
Oh.
Where did I go wrong? Anyway,
she
called me up and she said, I think we should go and have lunch at Lou the Greek's. Well, Lou the Greek's doesn't exist. It's not a real place. But my daughter...
But Lou's used to be in San Jose for years and years.
Joe's.
Oh, you're talking about
original Joe's.
But I wrote... Lou's Balkan Village.
A restaurant called Lou the Greek's.
But there's in Lou's Balkan Village was in San Jose for years.
Okay.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
San Jose is
not my town.
Isn't that funny how that works?
San Francisco.
I mean, you
town.
Made something up and it's close
Shut
to
Shut up through. About San Jose.
Okay. I have to be really. Is this
recording? Are we recording belligerent?
My wife is from San Jose. I got to be really careful.
Yeah. He told us before the thing. He said, you know, be belligerent.
Absolutely.
That's in case you think we are naturally this argumentative.
So you don't have to answer this, Bradley, but do you want to talk about how nuts you are?
Sure. Why not?
Go.
Well, I just want to say, first of all, that technically insanity is a legal definition, so I don't, you know, technically meet that criterion as a functioning member of society. But I would say I'm not schizophrenic. I'm more of a depressive. A lot of my work is pretty dark, and I come by that absolutely naturally. I think that for a lot of people...
Are your parents alive?
Yeah.
Did they read your stuff?
The new one they read. The last one I asked them not to. It's upsetting. But no, I don't think I'm that crazy. I mean, I function okay. Crazy in some ways, I suppose, like the kind of things you're talking about, where you end up doing these things that really don't make sense to people who don't spend their time doing all this stuff. I mean, I'm a classically trained actor and I write fiction, so it means I'm a really good liar. That's a weird thing to say, but I'm not a lawyer, so people hate me less. I don't know. I'll also say, though, I steal from everyone. So you don't really have to be crazy. If you listen to people, if you manage to not be a narcissist, you know, you can just pick up the craziest stories everywhere you go. And if you tell me anything, it's mine.
Good.
Good one.
So maybe we should take a little break now. And does anybody in the audience have questions that's provocative, learned, not literary? So do we have a... I want to be able to, you know,
understand.
Yeah, cut them off when they're not exciting enough.
We'll share.
Are your later books better than your earlier ones, or vice versa? Do you think, in your own opinion?
Who's that addressed to?
Well, Mr. John certainly has the highest numbers.
So have you been gradually deteriorating since your first book? Yes.
It just is going along with my physical decline. It's all of a piece, you know.
Are you happier with later ones over earlier?
You know, they're all your babies. I feel like I've tried as hard as I could and put out the best product I can. There's a couple of them that are not my favorites, but there's a couple of them that are. So I haven't noticed any decline in a normal, it's more like a graph that goes up and down. That's how I really feel.
Go, Thomas.
Yeah. Well, I definitely feel like I'm, like any craft, I feel like I'm getting better. Not necessarily like I get different interests and different things part of the work process, or I'm very not satisfied with my books. I think they're all crap when I put them in, and I hardly feel like reading them afterwards and all that. But I think it's just because I'm very ambitious. I want to write the best book, and I still haven't. So I want to be better and better, and just continue, you know, maturing and developing.
You'll get over it.
Yeah, unequivocal. Yes, the first two novels I wrote. I wouldn't even want to see them published now. Just too far away from that. I think I've gotten continually better. But that being said, yeah, they're all yours, and you have your favorites. You know, you definitely have your favorites. Killing Williamsburg is like a super close favorite to me for all these reasons, because I wrote it when I first moved to New York, and I was learning the city, and I was really digging in and getting into it. And I don't know that anything will have that kind of power over me again, even though I'm getting better. I'm doing things now that I couldn't have done then. And I can look back at that book now and go, yeah, that sentence is a little long. But, you know, you live with it. You know, you can't change it now.
Right. Okay, Tara's got a question.
I read a lot of Scandinavian thrillers and other European thrillers, and I'm just wondering for Tomas how you feel like the thrillers from Europe differ from the American thrillers.
So just recapping what you said, Tara, you wonder how Scandinavian thrillers compare to American thrillers. And it's for Tomas.
Well, I think it's hard to say for, you know, like, we want to say, you know, the European thrillers are like this and the American ones are like that. But really, I think that most of the very, very good Danish or even Scandinavian crime writers are very inspired by American crime writers. And I think it goes for most of Europe. I feel like you created or you invented the sort of the genre. So anyone who's writing that genre will learn from the American, you know, what the contemporary, also the previous things. But I think that, like I said earlier, if there is a, like, in later on, I'll be in the Nordic Noir thing, and it's so, I mean, I've been talking so much about the Nordic Noir, and it's hard to say what would really constitutes that genre. But I think it is what I mentioned earlier, that it has a, like an interest in sort of real life and maybe even making detectives that are sort of really boring, humane people and ordinary in a way, and then trying to lift that to new heights. But it's hard to say. I mean, I think if you're talking just good literary crime fiction, I think they're all learning from each other, basically.
So when you're talking about Scandinavian noir or Nordic noir, what time does it get dark around Christmas in Denmark?
Around 4 or something.
Yeah. So, you know, it just seems to me that influences what's going on. It's just noir, it's black, it's dark. Mm. So for a substantial part of the year.
It gets dark at 4 o'clock in New York by that time of
the
year.
No, I've lived over, no, it gets dark 2 hours earlier over there than here. And then anywhere in the 48 states. It's just dark.
Yeah. That could be it. So it's just a matter of the timing during the day. Yeah.
Of course, it's, you know, it's light at midnight too. So or 11.
I always thought thrillers required a lot of planning ahead, and so that you can build in all the details, so that by the end of the book you look back and you see how something happened. But from what I'm hearing from you, you guys just go and see where it leads you. Do you end up having to do a lot of back writing in order to counter that?
Well, I didn't. Yeah, I was listening to the way John was describing it, and I certainly don't work that way. Like, I'm not a big outliner. I don't plan all the stuff beforehand, but it's also not a truly linear process. Some books I've written completely out of order, and even with the Painted Gun, it was sort of front to back, but then through all the revisions, I'm constantly moving stuff around, excising stuff, and I throw away a ton of stuff. On my Bangkok book, I probably threw out 30, 40,000 words. I mean, I threw out almost a novel's worth of material, because the thing just ballooned so huge, and everything was in the wrong place, and it was just, it was like, it's more like making soup. You know, you start with a lot of water and you simmer it down for a long time until the taste is just perfect.
John, why don't you go ahead?
Well, as I said, I just start at the beginning and write till the end, and I'm frequently just lost. I don't even feel like I've got those headlights that Dr. Rowe was talking about. I mean, it's just blind. But I just keep doing it and putting down pages, and then I see what the pages give me to work with. That's a little different than everybody else, but I think Lee Child does the same thing. I've talked to Lee a lot about that, and, you know, he's doing okay, too.
Well, he said, Lee has said, you know, he paints himself into a corner frequently.
I mean, really,
What makes the book so exciting is he doesn't know how
he's
getting
out.
Yeah, he doesn't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And the book I'm writing now, you know, the 2019 book, you know, it's, I'm literally on page 93, and I don't have any idea what I'm going to write on Monday. And it makes me crazy. I mean, that's where I feel like I'm schizophrenic.
You just said you're crazy. Yeah.
See, I am. Because I'm waiting for this genie, you know, on my shoulder to show up and start preaching to me or something. And
so can I riff off that for a second? So you know, when you sit down in the chair, you don't know where you're, going at all.
I use new vulgarities every morning.
But something comes to you eventually. And so after every book, I would guess, yeah. Tell me if I'm right or wrong. After every book, you say, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what it's going to do. I've done 27 books. I don't know what's going to happen on the 29th. And you think, it's not going to happen this time.
I always think it's not going to happen.
Yes.
And this is book 29.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm thinking, that's it. My career is over.
Yeah, every time.
I'll never get another book.
Yeah. No.
That's really how I feel. It's a little nuts, but there it is.
But we all do, right?
I hope so.
Tomas?
I hope we're all in agony together.
Yeah, I have it like, I like to sort of put down the notes. Like in music, I like to put down the notes, and then I know when I'm there, I'm gonna improvise a whole lot. So that's how I feel in it. But I also need to hear the music. I need to know what's happening in a certain way. But the best experiences for me as a writer are those moments where it rails off, it detours, it goes somewhere you completely didn't expect it. Like I talked about with the sex scene was like something I thought I would never do, and it was like it just in the moment it just felt like the thing to do, and now it's like it was, you know, one of those scenes where, you know, the reviews were like it's the best sex scene ever and stuff like that. So, and I think that was for me a complete moment of just going along with the music, what was there available in the moment. And if you were planning so hard that no, I can't put it in there, then you're missing out on something. So for me, it's that kind of freedom. It's that kind of playfulness.
So Bradley, for me, writing a book is mostly work. But going along with what Tomas said, there are a few transcendent moments. You know, I sit down at the cafe, it's 8:30, and I look up and it's 3:30. And I don't even know what's happened, you know, and I've written it down, and yet there are all these thousands of words on the page. And that just doesn't happen very often. How about for you?
Yeah, it happens sometimes. I agree that it's mostly work. Mostly it's work. You just have to get up. You have to get in the chair. You just have to hate yourself enough to keep at it. but there are those moments where, and for me, they're usually the more lyrical passages, the more, you know, more flowery, a little bit more verbose, a little bit more poetic, like those kinds of bits that maybe isn't everybody's cup of tea, but to me, like a nice soaring passage can just be very crystal. Mm. And when those moments happen, it's beautiful.
Because
you usually know it, too. You usually know almost immediately after you've set something like that down, you just go, damn, that's good. Because normally we don't feel like that, right? Normally we don't feel like we're doing anything good at all.
Yeah. Right.
I didn't mean to bounce off of her question, but I guess I am in a way.
Okay with her?
I don't know. I didn't ask. I've heard a thriller described as a regular fiction story with some of the more key elements withheld. In what we're talking about here is the absence of description, the absence of information, what really helps structure as much as the presence. And is that deliberate or just what you forgot to type in when you're on a word stream at some point?
Wow.
Everything I withhold is on purpose. I mean, pretty much I would say that I'm not telling you because it's none of your business. Occasionally, I may not know the answer.
Yeah.
But even if I don't know the answer, I left it out on purpose. Because that's life, right? That's the whole thing. None of us know when we're going to die. None of us know how we're going to die. It's hanging over us every single day. And that's the one thing that we really all have in common that is inescapable. And it's sort of awful and also wonderful. It's why life is fun. So, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next.
On the subject of villains, Bradley, you talked about how villains some want to be good, and John, I think, suggested the district attorney who was prosecuting the wrong guy for the wrong reasons.
Right.
But what I want to know is, do villains think of themselves as bad?
I would say almost never. I think they just think of themselves as justified, almost no matter what they're doing. That's the reason that they're bad, is they have no moral compass. And that's why what we come to understand, the more we see them in action, And so we say, you know, this guy just bugs me, but he bugs me for a reason that I'm starting to get now. And the reason is that he doesn't make any good decisions. Everything he does makes the world worse. And he thinks it's just peachy keen. Doesn't remind me of anybody I know in the world today. But nevertheless, there is that feeling that if you can't do anything wrong, that's almost the definition of evil.
Well, it's what they say is that every person is the hero of his or her own autobiography.
Yeah.
But I think there's, I don't disagree, but I also say there's a large category of people who are in situations that they may no longer be able to control and are in a position where they have to do things that are quote-unquote evil. So you've gotten yourself into that spot and you're going to do this horrible thing, and you might still know that it's a horrible thing, but you're going to do it because you really don't have a choice. There's too much hanging over you, too many other things happening, too many responsibilities.
Yeah. A couple more questions, and then I'll you know, have lulled these three, and I'll hit them with some closeout questions.
I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit about each of your editorial processes in working with thrillers. I know you're with Acoustic and Simon & Schuster, and I'm wondering if you've worked with both editors in the U.S., or if that's just a separate translation process. And if there are any sort of special elements to the editorial process when you're working on a thriller, if your editor plays any particular role in terms of teasing out plot elements that might be different from the editorial process, and just what the different experiences have been.
So which of you has Maxwell Perkins as an editor? Bradley?
Yeah, absolutely. My editor is Aaron Petrovich at Akashic. I can't say enough nice things about him. He's really a nice guy to begin with, and he made my book much, much better. And there were absolutely whole threads that were retooled. And nothing came from him wholesale. He didn't say, you know, you need a Maltese Falcon right here. But he did say, there's a missed opportunity here. Why isn't there something else? And I dropped in another whole thread that went beginning to end and sort of answered that and found a way to bring things in a way that was both tighter and also, you know, more upsetting. You made certain characters more sympathetic, made certain evil deeds more upsetting. And there were a lot of little things like that.
So, John, do you want a nice editor? Don't you want an asshole editor?
I've only had nice editors, really. I mean, everybody wants the book to be as good as it can be. And so you better not have an ego around it.
Absolutely.
You better just go, well, that's a good idea. I'm not going to take it, but it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happened with all my books, is I hand in something that's already been severely edited at least three times, not just by me, but by my friend Al, the lawyer, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that I don't hand in. I never would hand in even a second draft. It's usually a third or fourth draft is what I hand in. And by then, if my editor wants to make comments, I'm open to them. Sometimes I've changed dramatic things, and sometimes I've said, no, I don't like that change, and I'm not going to do it.
So, Tomas, when I've been working with editors, it, almost every time it ends up being a third, a third, a third. A third of the time I say, wow, that makes it better. A third of the time I say, I don't know why that makes it better, but it doesn't make it worse, so I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And a third of the time I say, no, that's not what I meant. How about with you?
I think I say no most of the time, actually. Listening to you and also speaking to other writers, I feel like I'm missing out on the editing part, because with my first novel, I had almost no editing, and the second one was a bit the same, but actually with the English-American version, there was a lot of really, really interesting questions coming from the translator about stuff that I hadn't thought about, so maybe he was just more sort of whatever good at finding stuff, but that was interesting, because he was asking a lot, why would he, you know, wouldn't he use his right hand for this, and I'm like, whatever. it didn't really matter to me if it was one hand or the other, but yeah, if it felt better for him. But I mean, I also think the way that I work with my novels is also why I haven't put out a lot of stuff until now, is I've been rewriting so many times that by the time I put in something, it's fairly well worked through, but it is an essential thing. I mean, to get, I mean, it's the most beautiful, most scary moment is to have someone else read your stuff and edit or comment or whatever. And it's a very vulnerable process. I think it's so scary.
Heath, I gotta ask you if I did good because we're in Berkeley. I just remembered this. So my protagonist lives in South San Francisco, and whenever he drives into the city, he drives into the city, and I spelled it with a capital C. My editors, of course, none of them were from California, changed it throughout the book. And I fought for that shit, and I said, no, whenever we're talking specifically about the city, it's with a capital C, and I got it.
Yeah.
See, that's,
well, let me just add one other thing. There's two kinds of editors, really. There's the editorial editor, and then there is the copy editor.
And we all hate the copy editors.
Pox on copy editors.
Do we have any copy editors out here?
The simplest thing is to know quotation marks. That means people are talking. Oh, really? And sometimes when people talk, it never happens to me or anybody in this room, I'm sure, they don't use perfect English. And my copy editors, in every single case, change my dialogue.
Oh, man.
My life. It's my bread and butter.
I
love dialogue.
I have a great copy editor, so.
Not the copy editor.
Yeah. She's trilingual, too, she says. She speaks American, Canadian, and English.
Does she know what a quotation mark is for?
Well, she has a little, when she's speaking English, it's just one. And when she's speaking American English, it's two. She's great.
Okay.
So if anybody wants looking for a good one, I know a good one. But okay. But I haven't always had a good one. And yes,
when you don't have one, you remember it.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, this is a
25 bad ones. You remember that too.
Well, what Bradley's talking about is life, because I go back and forth between the East Coast and the West Coast as well. And when you're in certain areas of the United States, the city means Manhattan, and in certain other areas, it means San Francisco.
Exactly.
And of course, in which you if you have a male sports copy editor, you say, look at the Dubs uniforms. It says the city. There you go. One more question.
I take the point that at least several of you said you write a story. That is, the question of what is a thriller, what is a mystery, is maybe more of a marketing question. Yet here we are in a discussion about thrillers, not about mysteries. So to take an example, if we are going to classify things, the Le Carré classic, Tinker Tailor, is that a mystery or a thriller? And I'm guessing one answer is it doesn't matter. But
well, of course,
I'm
it is. I mean, it's certainly a thriller, but it's also a whodunit, is what you're saying.
Right. So if it's a whodunit, it's a mystery?
Yeah, and the title says thriller. The title doesn't say, you know, a case of murder. If you had the word murder in the title, it'd be called a mystery.
Nothing else? All right. So John, you mentioned Lee Child?
Yeah.
So Lee said, don't give your readers what they enjoyed last year. Give them what they are going to enjoy next year. So for you, this seems like a particular problem because you don't have to figure out what they're going to enjoy next year. You have to figure out what they're going to enjoy
in decade.
In 2019.
Exactly.
So how do you do that?
I just believe that it's going to show up.
Come on, elaborate a little bit for us, John.
I got to tell you, the job is going into work. I go in, I sit down every morning, and I sit there till 5 o'clock, and that's what I do.
And how do you get something fresh and new after when you're on work on your 29th novel?
That's a little challenging, I'll be honest with you. But that's what you try to do. I'm starting to think I may be one of the few people who really does it this way. But all I'm really interested in is getting a scene that's going to be exciting and fun. Mm. And if I get the scene and I pile enough of them up, it turns into a book.
Is that how it works for you, Tomas?
No, well, yeah, I can recognize some of that, but for me, it's I don't care. I mean, actually.
So I'm sorry, Tomas. Have you written your third Hermit book?
I'm writing it now.
So how do you keep it fresh and different from the first two? How do you know what people are going to want to read 2 years from now?
Well, I don't think too much about that. I think about what interests me and what's, you know, what I'm interested in doing. And I mean, that's that's the only way. You need to feel like it's fresh when you go there, and it's like you're still interested in the character, and you're still interested in the story, what's going to happen. And like I said earlier, that I, for me, it's really, I feel like I'm the detective also in writing it, and I love that. That's such a privilege to sit there and just you know go to work in that way and not risk your own life, but you can just sit there in a museum and write a story, right? So it's a privilege.
Riley, you want to get something in here?
Yeah, I think that I'm ahead by a lot. Killing Williamsburg took over 10, maybe about 12 years from the time I completed it to the time it was published. The Painted Gun, I believe I finished that in 2006, came out in 2017. So I'm beginning to think that's my thing. I'm just 10 years ahead. Yeah. I just gotta wait.
I think, so now that you say that, I think that that's a little bit of my problem too. My third novel is called Drop by Drop. In the center of the plot is a conspiracy between elements of the CIA and the Russians to fix a presidential election.
Seriously?
Okay. I was 6 years early. Ah, well. So if you could be doing anything with your life, if you could be an actor, if you could be Viggo Mortensen, I got a Dane in there for you, a Viggo Mortensen or Tom Brady or Mark Zuckerberg, would you still be writing thrillers? Is that what you're meant to do? Or do you have daydreams about being someone that you're not? Bradley?
I do a lot of different things, and I write a lot of different things. I think that I'm a pretty good writer. I'm probably better at it than I was as an actor. I'm an okay actor. I'm a much better writer. And I got into writing because ultimately, as an actor, I was bored. I didn't have enough skin in the game. You just stand over there and you say these five lines and then you're done. And I'm like, no, because this script is fucking terrible. And who wrote this dialogue? So I think that I'm just, enough of a workaholic that no matter what I was doing on some level, I'd be wanting to make my own stuff to be able to say, this is what I did. You might not like it, but it's what I wanted it to be.
Tomas?
Well,
you could be doing anything. You could be anyone.
Well, I think the biggest thrill is to transport readers to different places and give them this ride through this experience. So recently I played Uncharted 4 with my daughter. She's 14, and we played this game, and that was an amazing experience to play that game because it's so immersive, and you get in there and there's a great story and the characters are fun. So I mean, I would love to create games or something like that, but that's just same creative process, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I would be a writer any day.
Me too. It's been my full-time job now for 30 years, and it's been fantastic, actually. I couldn't have asked for a better career. The one sad thing in my life is that the rock and roll star thing did not work out.
So you'd rather be a rock and roll
star?
Well,
I was a singer until I was 30. I had a band and everything, and that's what I did. And then I quit on my 30th birthday, and I started my novel on the day after.
So you've been on the New York Times top 10 bestseller list many times. How many times did you make it on the Billboard top 10?
They have really ignored me. But I have a couple of CDs out. I mean, I'm still doing it. I'm playing a lot, and I'm building a guitar in winter, so music is still a big part of my life. And I've written hundreds of songs, so some of them even good. So,
John, can you name one thriller writer who's really inspired you?
Lawrence Saunders, The First Deadly Sin. Changed my whole worldview.
Elaborate
just because it was so unbelievable. This Daniel Blank, bad, talk about a villain. This guy went around and killed people with a ski axe, drove it through their head. And then he also had this fantastic detective who was retired. His wife was dying. He's all screwed up guy. But he had to go and get this guy, Daniel Blank. And that book totally changed my worldview in terms of what I'd like to do in writing.
Do either of you have someone comparable to Lawrence Saunders?
I don't get so hung up on genres, but I would say James Ellroy. Like when I first read American Tabloid, mm-hmm. I just thought, God, this guy just writes like a machine gun. It's upsetting. It gets into your head, and then you're walking around seeing the whole world like these sentences. You walked into the conference room. The meeting was in 5 minutes. The Excel spreadsheet was open. You really start to see your world that way, and you're like, oh my God, that guy is sick and twisted.
Tomas?
Well, my main inspiration, like literary stuff, is I think people like Paul Auster, Murakami, Dostoevsky. So,
I've asked this question before when I moderate. I've heard no one say Paul Auster before.
Oh.
No, I think he's a fabulous writer. I've just never heard anybody say him before in this context. No. He's a fabulous writer.
Yeah. And also, like, I had a debate recently about that, you know, Crime and Punishment is actually, a crime fiction story. I mean, it's not not in the ordinary sense, but it's about a crime, and you don't follow the detective, but you follow the
Well, this is Lawrence Block's definition of a mystery versus literary fiction, which we discussed a little bit earlier. Mm. A mystery is a novel with a crime at its heart. In literary fiction, is a mystery with crime at its heart that sells more than 10,000 copies. It transcends the genre then.
Yes, yes.
So this is a question, I mean, I know I asked the question, but one I want to answer, which is a little embarrassing for me, is that the person who inspired what I write isn't an author per se, it's Alfred Hitchcock. Mm. What I love is Jimmy Stewart or something, or Teresa Wright, getting caught up in something. You know, Mr. or Ms. Middle Class American, all of a sudden getting caught up in something and having to elevate themselves to be a hero. Mm. That's what I love, and it's Hitchcock who inspired me for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
All right. Do after 27 books, what about movies or TV? John?
Any directors in the room?
Do you think about your books becoming movies as you write them?
I got a call yesterday, your email, actually Friday, from a guy, Tiny Riot Films in L.A., and he's going to talk to my agent, and nothing's going to happen. So that'll be great.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. I had Lawrence Fishburne optioned all my work about 3 years ago, all of my Dismas Hardy stories, and we got to the day before, we had a showrunner, we had stars, we had everything there. And the day before, they canceled the deal. So, but you know what? There's so many good things that have happened, I can't really worry about that.
You know, so Ridley Scott's company called my agent and said, we're interested in his books.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really resentful for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Because a week later, he said, no, he said, I've read them, I really like them, but it's not what I had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why couldn't he have told me no after 2 months?
Well, here's a good
Leave
one.
Me with the fantasy.
Here's a good months. One. I'm sitting at my desk maybe 30 years ago, 25 years ago, broke as a church mouse, and I had just handed in my book, A Certain Justice. And I get a call from, who's the guy who did The Exorcist, the director?
Friedkin.
Friedkin. Yeah. Yeah, Billy Friedkin. And he goes, John, it's Billy. Billy, how you doing, dude? Listen, this is my next book. This is going to be my next. I just read it. I couldn't put it down. It's unbelievable. He said, I'll be in touch with your agent tomorrow. I said, wow, that's great. So we hang up. It's great. And I said, cocaine is a great drug. Because this guy never even called my agent. And it was not a fake phone call. It was really him because they said, please hold for Mr. Friedkin and all that good stuff. And then nothing at all happened. So that's a good moment.
So Bradley, you're an actor and a director too, right?
Yes, why not? Sure. Listen, if you ever worked with actors, you don't ever want anybody to call you an actor.
Do you write thinking cinematically?
Yeah, I came from that world. I studied theater, so of course I'm always going to think that way first. I definitely would love to see my books as films. I already see them as films. I don't have to write the thing because I'm sick of them.
Yeah. And believe
somebody
me,
else
this guy
can
from
write
Tiny
it.
Riot Films or whatever it is, if he wants to buy it, I'll sell it to him.
No, and everybody has these stories. It's really rough out there. It's really rough. And you almost would rather just somebody make the thing, you know, even if there's no money in it. Rather than somebody give you a bunch
like
of money
walking,
and 3 years later, like
you'd like to be in your hometown walking down the street and look at the marquee and say, oh, they made a movie of my book.
That's right.
Tomas, movies?
Yeah.
Do you care? Do you think about it?
Not when I'm writing it. I mean, I definitely didn't when I wrote my debut novel. It was like it's completely not in my head. But then it was optioned for a Spanish production company, and also I have an American company looking at it. But it's like what these guys are saying. If it happens, it happens. But actually, I think the TV series right now is the shit.
Oh, yeah.
So
that's
that would be
that's
really
the new way.
So we've got about a minute and a half to go. That gives each of you 30 seconds to tell the audience what comes next.
Mm.
John, you could start.
Well, I've got a book coming out next year. As soon as I know the title, I'll let you all know. When that book's done, then I'll probably be pretty close to finish the 2019 book. And
is that a Dismas Hardy?
Yes, it is. It is a Dismas Hardy. So is the 2018 book. But the 2019 book, isn't this weird to talk this way? Book three of the deal. Book three is about Dismas Hardy, but it brings back some of the characters from Fatal, and which is what I've tended to
colliding
do, is introduce
universes.
People in Colliding Universe and things explode. Yeah.
Bradley.
So I just was here in San Francisco in March. I did a crazy immersive event with City Lights Books where we had the audience like running around on the streets of North Beach, and we filmed all of that, a lot of it with surveillance cameras. So we're currently editing that together to piece that into a couple of small films. So that's going to be cool. Watch out for that. I'm sure City Lights will be pimping it. And it was a really fun night. And then after that, I want to take a break because I've been on the road for a while and kind of want to mellow out. And then maybe this fall I'll get back to a screenplay that I had to put down when all of this started happening.
Yeah, I think John and I would like to take a break too, but we like to eat. Tomas, what's next for you?
Yeah, well, I'm writing the third part of the trilogy of this Erhard Jørgensen, and it's really exciting. And it's also, I mean, it's really nice to sort of be at the end of the story in the sense that there's a lot you can't do in the first book and you can't do in the second. So I'm tying all the knots, and it's really exciting. And then I have like 10, 50 other books I want to get started on. So, I mean, I debuted when I was 40, and I feel like I'm really busy now because I want to put out so many books. So, yeah.
So after we're done here, we're going downstairs to sign books. You should all come and buy books written by these three. Were they great? Great panelists? And you all were a great audience. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.